Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the May 2023 Home Education Conference held in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Sure glad you're here. I'm kind of excited to hear what I'm going to say. And I think I'm supposed to say that I'm H. Wallace Goddard, and we're going to talk about four essentials of effective parenting. Isn't that what we're supposed to say right off the bat? And I need to introduce the person who's taught me more than anyone else about parenting. Nancy? This is my wife, Nancy. She is the best parent I know and the kindest person I've ever met. So glad you're here, sweetheart. thank you. I agree with that. And you referenced some of the books. If you're interested, you can look at some of these books up here. And I've provided, when I was at Auburn University, we created a series called Principles of Parenting, and I brought copies of three of the most important of those publications. They're at the back, they're free. Also, when I was at the University of Arkansas, I created something called Blueprint for Happiness. We'll talk briefly about the research discoveries on happiness and well-being. And so there are a few of those available at the back. And Nancy and I published a children's book, and we're giving away copies free at the back. It's called God's Trophies. So if you want a copy, and if you can always take it and sell it on eBay, so it's free. So four essentials of effective parenting. I bet some of you have heard the story. It's apparently a true story about a woman in central Utah who was told by her daughter, who was in middle school, that she was supposed to take a new T-shirt in her size to school in order to put a drug message on it, an anti-drug message. And so the appointed day came when the girl was to take the T-shirt to school. She asked her mom, "Did you get that T-shirt for me?" And mom said, "Oh, I forgot, but let's see what we can find." So they rummaged around in her closet and found a shirt that had a message on the front but nothing on the back. And mom said, "That's going to have to do." So the daughter took the shirt to school, and in the course of the day, they silk screened on the anti-drug message. But then when she came home with the shirt, it had an interesting combination of messages. On the front was the original messages, "Families are forever." On the back was the new message, "Be smart, don't start." That is not, I think, the solution to family dilemmas, but I loved that combination of messages. I thought it was very, very serendipitous. So let's talk about some principles. The starting place is probably this. I turned to King Benjamin, who was a great parenting expert. He said, "The natural parent is an enemy to children and has been from the fall and will be forever and ever and ever and ever unless the yield to the enticings of the Holy Spirit and put off the natural parent and become saints through the atonement of Christ the Lord." I happen to believe that that is literally true, that we as humans are wired to take care of ourselves, and the demands of parenting require us to do everything that's unnatural for us. And that is by divine design and not by accident. It is God's plan that we be stretched in order to become more like God himself is. So I'd like to talk about these principles of parenting. This is years ago in the 1990s, a group of scholars was appointed by the federal government to create a summary of what the most important principles of parenting are. I was a part of that four-person team, and we came up with six principles. I like to represent it in this way rather than the way we ended up in that federal project. This is how I like to show it, that the foundation, or even below that, the footings that support everything, is the flourishing person, the person who's happy and feels purposeful and feels like they're connected to God and have reasons to live. A person who is miserable has a hard time being an effective parent. So I think flourishing parenting is the footers. The foundation, I would say, is compassion. Compassion is what translates our well-being into our effectiveness in dealing with children. Lots and lots, most, I would say almost every parenting program I know emphasizes one thing, which is how to control children. The problem with that is controlling children doesn't enlarge, increase, improve their agency. It doesn't. It may keep them from going to juvenile court, but it doesn't make them into better people. So compassion connects the healthy person to the challenges of children. Instead of being focused on guidance or controlling, it brings these as parallel processes. Guidance cannot happen effectively in the absence of quality nurturing. And I think that most parenting programs emphasize guidance because that's where parents' pain is. But research says that no parenting is effective in the absence of nurturing, period. Let me say that again. No parenting is effective in the absence of nurturing, a loving, caring, connected relationship. In the absence of that, no parenting is effective. It doesn't work. So I offer these as parallel processes. They have to go together. I also believe that ultimately the top of the house is purpose. If our only hope is to have children who make us proud, the kind of parenting we do will be different from if what we're trying to do is create people who are becoming ever more like God, who are becoming strong and capable and caring, committed people. So with this will be the framework I'll use. I'll talk about these four principles in turn and just give a quick shout out to the idea of purpose. So the first principle, have a flourishing life. One of the people I appreciate most in this area is a guy named Martin E.P. Seligman, who is president of the American Psychological Association. He, in 1998, as president, gave his presidential address to the organization. And he said, "We in the psychological community have gotten really good at treating sickness, but we haven't done nearly enough in helping people flourish, move on from stability to well-being, to being happy, joyous, vibrant. We haven't done a very good job of that." And he gave a challenge to the psychological community to start creating something that would, many things that would help people do that. And he himself in 2002 published a book called Authentic Happiness, which I recommend heartily. He came up with five things that he says are essential for our well-being. And if we had 2 hours together, I'd take an hour on what he taught there, because as we become healthy, vibrant, balanced people, we automatically become better parents. We don't have that time, so I put asterisk by the two that I will mention cursorily today. The first is savoring the present. I could ask you, if we had the time, what I'd love to do is have every person in the room tell about one, two, or three things that you have already enjoyed today. I mean, have you noticed the sweet and beautiful blessings you've already received today? I tell you, for me, one of them was hugging Nancy. You should try it. Let's form a line, and each of you take a turn hugging Nancy, and see if you enjoy it as much. Well, you might not enjoy it as much as I do, but holding the person I love most on this earth is a joy, and her companionship, her friendship, her partnership. So if we savor, Seligman and the research say, when you notice, enjoy, celebrate, appreciate simple things in your life, it makes a difference. Your well-being grows as you focus on good things that are happening. Now notice, there is a famous bias in human thinking. It's called negativity bias, a real catchy title. And what it says is we as humans are programmed to be especially attentive to, aware of, and notice, focus on bad things, which is really pretty adaptive, because if you don't notice the bad, there was a time when maybe you'd get eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. And the the population of saber-toothed tigers is really down right now, but we still have the negativity bias. We are still always looking for a threat, which is probably adaptive in traffic. It's less adaptive in your home environment, where we experience other family members as threatening to us instead of little people who are just trying to get their needs met. So the savoring the present is really the remedy for this. And one of the things that Seligman recommends is that we list at least two or three went wells every single day. And I happen to have with me somewhere here. There it is. Right in, there we go. There are different ways of doing this. I have a month at a glance calendar in which I write down every single day of my life for 50 plus years what I did that day, just in an outline form. It's a small square and it allows only a few words. But those are the large plates of Wally. These are the small plates of Wally where I write the things of my heart. And on the small plates, I write those places where I felt like heaven reached across eternity and touched or blessed me. And virtually every day starts with hugging Nancy. And yet there are others. There are others, like last night Nancy and I met with a friend who lives here in Salt Lake and her daughter. And we went out to dinner and delightful people, and we just love them. We just love their souls. And it was a joy to be with them. So that's in here. When we find some way to write down every single day of our lives things that went well, we become happier people. I wish I had time to tell you about our friend William Howard III, a young black man with muscular dystrophy who lived in the South when we were in Arkansas. And once when we visited him at the state hospital, and I asked William, how are you? And he said, "Wally, I can breathe. And it just doesn't get any better than that." Now, I don't know. If you stop breathing right now, how soon would you start missing it? Yeah, it wouldn't take very long, would it? And it turns out, ironically, that with his muscular dystrophy, when T got pneumonia, he died because he couldn't breathe, because he couldn't clear his lungs. Well, noticing just sunshine, noticing flowers, noticing the good gets us above our negativity bias and helps us to move into that flourishing zone. You remember when President Eyring gave us the challenge, tonight and tomorrow night you might pray and ponder asking the question, did God send a message that was just for me? Did I see his hand in my life or the lives of my children? I will do that. And then I will find a way to preserve that memory, whether it's on the computer or in book form or in whatever way. Some people take pictures of the things for which they're grateful. I will do that, and then I will find a way to preserve that memory for the day that I and those that I love will need to remember how much God loves us and how much we need him. I testify that he loves us and blesses us more than most of us have yet recognized. I know that is true, and it brings me joy to remember him. So each of us needs to find a way to savor the present. That, intriguingly, is the foundation of well-being. And I should probably mention that Martin Seligman can't quite decide if he's an atheist or an agnostic. The reason I mention that is because when he recommends this, it isn't just a cute idea he got at Sunday school. He ain't been going to Sunday school. He's reporting what research says. Research says that when we notice, enjoy, celebrate, appreciate, and record good things that are happening in our lives get better. We have a more continuing sense of God's goodness. And I think that's entirely consistent with what God has always recommended. Here's my dear Nancy with Sarah, our baby girl. And Nancy has kept journals not only for herself, but for our children. When they were too young to write themselves or too young to be willing to keep a journal, Nancy kept a journal for them. And now, as they themselves are parents, she sends them excerpts from their childhood journals. It is a joy to them, and it is a joy to us. The second principle that I want to talk about is this. you may or may not recognize that this is Rachel Carson. She warned that today more American children, school children, die of cancer than any other disease. It moved from fifth place as a killer of children to first place. That sounds ominous. And of course, in the context of her book, Silent Spring, the message was, all these chemicals are in our environment are killing us, and we've got to get rid of them. What she didn't say that really ought to be said is the reason cancer moved from fifth place to first place was that we conquered the top four killers of children. The base rate of cancer has not changed significantly, but we conquered the diseases that were killing children. Do you see how beautifully mass media can turn really joyous, beautiful, uplifting, encouraging messages into tragedy? And that's one of the messages of, there's a great book called The Science of Fear by Gardner. Gardner talks about all the ways that mass media tries to scare us into tuning into their program. And that's the key for mass media. By scaring us every day, every night, they get us to tune in to where, whatever it is, ABC News or something different. Gardner says this. He says, gratitude, not fear, should be the defining feeling of our age. And yet, it is fear that defines us. We worry. We cringe. It seems the less we have to fear, the more we fear. For most people in the world today, there's never been a better time to be alive. So, many of us, as we scan the future, we feel anxiety about what if my kids have some kind of health problems, or what if, we do a lot of what-ifing, don't we? And in the process, we keep ourselves miserable even in the midst of purposeful, meaningful, peaceful lives. And think about the fact that for the bulk of the history of this world, one of the greatest concerns any human had was finding enough to eat. That's not the biggest problem most of us worry about. Some of us are worried about eating less. I had two breakfasts because they were free. That's really smart, isn't it? I know, it's dumb. I don't know what's wrong with me. But if you grow up with kind of a scarcity mentality, then you're always afraid there's not going to be enough. And you act in ways that don't serve your own best interest. If you read Gardner's book, you realize, wow, through most of history, one of the biggest fears people had was that a neighboring community would come and slaughter them in their sleep. I don't know about you, but I don't think that's been happening much around the Provo area or American Fork. We do, of course, have accidents on the freeway, but the loss of life today is nothing like it has been historically. So, in the back, there's some copies of, or there may still be, there's still a couple of copies of Blueprint for Happiness. It's a publication our team created when I was at the University of Arkansas that summarizes those five principles that Seligman talks about. And since we don't have nearly enough time to discuss all five, I provided that. Also, if you search on Blueprint for Happiness and University of Arkansas, it'll bring you to that URL. To find the entire thing as a PDF, which then, if you're interested, you could use with your children. You could share it with neighbors, family, friends. It's the second principle. You remember that in that house structure I showed you, that the next level was compassion. Compassion. I just absolutely love compassion. I want to tell you a story. Nancy and I had this experience when our daughter, Emily, was in kindergarten. When one day her good friend Donna came across the street to our house and said, hey, can Emily go with me to the playground? Now, the school is directly across the street from us, and so we were glad to let the girls go play there. So Donna came, got Emily, they headed to the school ground. As they got to the road, which happened to be a thoroughfare, Emily stopped to look for traffic. Donna did not. Donna ran into the street and was hit by a passing car. The good news is that the car had seen these girls coming and wondered if they would stop, and he started slowing, but he didn't get stopped before he hit Donna and sent her, this little five-year-old, flying some distance, skidding to a painful heap in the road. Now, as we talk about compassion, think about, would it be compassionate for us to go to Donna and said, Donna, we've got some little orange traffic cones, and we're going to set them up around your little pained carcass here and let you think about what you've done, because you now are suffering the consequences of a bad decision. Some of you are ready to slap me for even suggesting the possibility, aren't you? Because you have compassion. That is unthinkable. Even though Donna brought pain on herself, our response must never be indifference. Ever. That's not compassionate. It is not the way Jesus responds to our pain, and it is not how he asks us to respond to each other's pain. It is perfectly clear what we'll do. We will send someone to grab Donna's mom and bring her over, and we will get her as comfortable as we can. We'll go inside for a washcloth and get it damp and put it on those open skid wounds, and we will send for whatever medical help is appropriate. We will do anything and everything we can to assure her healing, won't we? There's no question about it. And that's what compassion is, please.
So at what point are we doing that so that they assume that everyone else is going to treat them that way, or so that they think that they are enabled or can't do it for themselves? Mom, will you go get me a glass of water?
Yeah. And I would say that that's not compassion. I would say that that's something different, maybe more like entitlement. Compassion is responding to distress with caring and action. But distress is the essential element. And so let's think about that more as we get to the yet future principle of guidance, shall we? Okay. So there's no question in this case how we'll respond to Donna. Remember how it says beautifully in Alma chapter 7 about how Jesus not only bore our sins, but he took upon himself all of our infirmities. He took plantar fasciitis, male pattern baldness. He took it all. Plus, every cancer known to humanity. He took every pain, disappointment, every hurt, every loss. And he himself experienced them. So that we could never rightly say to him, you don't understand. He informed his compassion the hard way by bearing what all of us will ever bear in the way of pain or disappointment. Wow! Who can say enough of his goodness, his mercy? Who can say enough of his great soul? Well, the scholarly definition for compassion has two elements. One is empathy. It's the feeling of distress for someone else's distress. That's the start. But the way compassion is richer than empathy is it also includes altruism or action. Compassion means that not only do I see the distress and feel it, which is empathy, but I want to do something about it. It's not enough to weep with you. I want to do anything in my power to help you. Now, you've asked a key question, which is, when is that too much? And I hope we'll give a better answer for that yet future. I love the statement by Joseph Smith. He was actually talking, I think it was at the Organization of the Relief Society, when he said, the nearer we get to our Heavenly Father, the more we are disposed to look with compassion on perishing souls. We feel that we want to take them upon our shoulders and cast their sins behind our back. Then he said, my message is intended for all of this company. If you would have God have mercy on you, have mercy on one another. Oh, wow. Wow. If we want mercy, if we who so desperately need some heavenly mercy, if we want it, we'd better be willing to show it. We'd better be Christ-like. So, when children are distressed, think back to Donna's example. When a child is in pain, it is not the right time to be giving platitudes and sermons. It is not. And in fact, let me give this example. This is from my all-time favorite parenting book, one written by Haim Gnat way back in the 60s, but revised and updated by his widow and me. And this book, he tells a story about two cousins, Carol and Susie. Susie came from her distant town and spent the summer with Carol, and they laughed and played every day of the summer. They would go to the corner store and buy ice cream. They slept out. They did all these glorious things all summer long. And then summer ended, and Susie had to go home. And Carol was a mess. She was absolutely desolate. And she started saying things like, I can't go on, Mom. This is awful. I just can't stand it. And she whined and cried, and Mom got quite impatient. She said, look, you'll find another friend, or you'll get over it, or you're 12 years old and you're such a crybaby. Now, does that sound like compassion to you? It doesn't to me. Or it's not uncommon for us to say, hey, when I was your age, I lost 47 friends, and I'm doing just fine. For which the 12-year-old might respond, I'm not so sure that your compassion is flourishing, Mom. Haim Gnat suggests responses like these. He suggests things like, he'll be so lonely without Susie. He'll be so lonely. See, compassion is about entering someone else's experiences and then giving an expression. So to say something like, it'll be so lonely without Susie, or you miss her already, or it's hard to be apart when you're so used to being together, or another one he suggested was, the house must feel so empty without her. Don't you love that? That someone captures the feeling, the emotional experience of loss, and puts it into words. The house must feel so empty with Susie gone. Which is really a metaphor for saying you must feel so empty with her gone. One reason I think this book is the best parenting book ever written is because it combines compassion with necessary limits. There have to be limits, but compassion, in fact, we'll talk about what Gottman says. Gottman talks about four ways of responding to strong emotional expression. So whether it's Donna in the road, or whether it's Carol whose cousin Susie has gone away, whatever the dilemma, he suggests there are four ways we typically respond. The first one is dismissive. Now let's use the example of a child who's angry with her sibling. Say, oh honey, you don't really hate your brother. You don't really want to murder him. You just feel that way right this minute. Dismissive. We dismiss the feeling. Or disapproving. You don't hate your brother, and I hate it when you say that. Okay, and laissez-faire. Laissez-faire is probably where most of us are, spend most of our time. It's when you worry about it and you want to do the right thing, but you don't know what that is. So you just kind of paralyze. You want to help and don't know what to do. The last and of course the most effective is emotion coaching. Now, Gottman, who's famous for his research on marriage, has also done research on parenting. And in that research, he's developed something that he calls emotion coaching. You could buy his book, Raising an Emotionally Intelligent Child, and I think it's a bad investment. Just go on the web and find the five steps, or write them down right now. The five steps of emotion coaching. Most of the book is scaffolding around those five steps. And I don't think the book as a whole is the great investment. Yeah, or you could use your camera because you're smart and you think of things like that. So the first is be aware of child's emotions. Be aware of their feelings. Notice, be tuned in, be aware of those things as they're experiencing them. The second is, and this is, I think, this is brilliant, recognize the emotion as an opportunity for intimacy and connecting or teaching. Wow, it's an opportunity. When kids have deep pain, frustration, it's a unique opportunity. Their souls, the doors to their souls are thrown wide open. You have the opportunity to experience them when they're in pain and hurt and open and vulnerable. instead of experiencing as an inconvenience that messes up our dinner schedule, we can experience as a cherished person having their soul opened to us. Then you listen empathetically and validate the child's feelings. Were you going to ask something? Yeah. Yeah, you've underscored the vital point, which is each child experiences and processes their pain differently, don't they? And so some children, very much, they'll just want to climb up in your lap and be held. Other children, okay. And yeah. And sometimes all we can do at the moment is say something like, "That was really hard. Oh, that was awful. I am so sorry." And if that's all they're ready for, then we say, "Man, I would love to hear more of your feelings when you're ready." But that's the key, isn't it? To tune into what they're ready for. Yeah. So listen empathetically and validate their feelings. Yeah. I mean, you saw how those comments from Haim Gannat between Carol and Susie, between Mom and Carol, actually, you saw how, the house seems so empty without her. That's empathy at work, expressing what she's seen inside of her daughter, not trying to drag her to healing, but be with her in her pain, which is what Jesus did in the Garden of Gethsemane. He sat with each of us in our pain. And then help the child verbally label emotions. Yeah, I wonder if you feel really lonely right now, really lost. You just miss her so much. So the verbal labeling of the emotions, and then set limits while helping the child problem solve. Like if Carol were to say, "Well, I'll pack my bags and I'll go move in with Susie." Setting limits means, "Boy, I wish you could. It would be so nice if you could just live together." And that doesn't work, but what we could do is, how about if you call her right now and tell her how much you love her? Or why don't you write her a note or create a picture that expresses to her what the summer was all about? And so you set limits while helping the child problem solve, helping them take positive action. Does that make sense?
Right. Setting limits is the hardest part.
It is hard, yeah. And one of the tricks, let's be honest, one of the tricks is, each of us is better at either setting limits or being empathetic. And when we ask you to do both, we're asking that you stretch on one side or the other, whichever is your weaker side, which I hate to say it, but that's God's plan. God wants us to learn not only what already comes easily for us, but learn what we still need to stretch into. So, 5 steps of emotion coaching. This is compassion in action. Incidentally, when Gottman wrote his book, Raising an Emotionally Intelligent Child, he dedicated it to the work and memory of Dr. Haim G. Gannat. So his feeling about Gannat is similar to mine. In the back is a publication called Being Understanding, A Key Developing Healthy Children. From my Auburn days. There should be plenty of those, so you can each have one if you like. There's the book. There's Haim Gannat. The third principle, focus on the relationship. Focus on the relationship. Most of the parenting programs I know are very focused on control. And I want to tell you something as fairly, but as emphatically as I can, which is all the research says that control in the absence of a relationship is not effective. You may be able to restrain children for a time, but our goal is not restraint, it's training of their souls. We want what in the field we call moral internalization. We want children to choose right things for right reasons, for internal reasons. They choose what they do because they know it's right. That sounds good, doesn't it? But it doesn't happen when all the control they experience in their lives is external. Now, that's as you might imagine, that's not easy. But here's some suggestions around focusing on the relationship. Make regular deposits in their emotional bank account. Use their language of love and the preponderance of positives. In the marriage research, you probably know that the single best predictor of a healthy relationship is five positives for each negative, five positive interactions for each negative interaction. And many scholars have thought that same thing applies to marriage. I don't think we have the research, to parenting. I don't think we have that research yet, but it makes sense that in our relationships with children, that preponderance of positives is really powerful. So, let's see if that'll advance. There we go. One of the things I admire about Nancy is the way she totally invests herself in the people she loves. It's a beautiful thing. Here she is with Emily, with Sarah. Here she is with Andy. When we moved to Alabama, Andy was a teenager, Nancy really has liked doing one-on-ones with the kids. So she said to Andy, "What would you like to do, Andy? What can I do with you?" And he says, "How about if we go mountain biking?" Now, you probably don't know that in Alabama, all of nature is trying to destroy every human it can find. There are briars, we were in Auburn, and there were all these hilly paths, and it was pretty hazardous. And Nancy isn't a person who loves high risk, but she does love Andy. And Andy knows that because his mama went biking with him, mountain biking. Well, one-on-ones, I'm not saying you have to do the thing you hate most. Sometimes you have to negotiate a little to find something that you feel okay about. But to carve out in your life time with each child to do things that are important to them. Emily is a person who loved to sew. She loves to create with fabric. And Nancy would go with her to the fabric store, and they would pick fabric and undertake projects. So Nancy's one-on-ones, I think, are an important part of that relationship building. Shirley. Yeah.
It is so hard. And my it son is. Misses it.
Yeah.
But with and we have 10 acres and all this stuff, it is hard for me to get.
Yeah.
What's your great advice for the more kids you get to still have that quality one-on-one?
I would quote the parenting expert named Jesus, to be as wise as serpents and harmless as doves. So sometimes, if you can see that there's a child who is especially feeling lonely, lost, destitute, you take maybe that's your third child, and you take the oldest and you say, "Hey, you are so good at helping the kids do such and such. Would you help them do that while I take so-and-so to do what they need to do?" You build alliances with the older children, let them help you with the parenting task. And that's why I think he says to be as wise as serpents but harmless as doves. Our intent is absolutely gracious, generous, charitable. But if we don't use wisdom, we'll never get it done, especially with 8 children. But building that, sometimes children will actually find it just very empowering to say, "Mom, trust me to take care of this and this, and she's put me in charge of the children." Now, if you have a child who has some power tendencies, you want to be a little cautious about setting that up. But you usually know enough about the children to know exactly what you can ask them to do that won't result in the loss of any children in your family. Right? So, think about this. We often say, "Love thy neighbor as thyself." And Jesus said, "No, we are so done with that. I'm giving you a new commandment that transcends that, a new commandment that is as different as night and day from that." He said, "A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another the way I have loved you. By this and by this alone will men know that you are my disciples, that you have love one to another." Now, remember the context for Jesus giving this directive. He has He's approaching the Last Supper and he washes his disciples' feet. He washes their feet, to which Peter objects strenuously, saying, "You are not washing my feet." And Jesus says, "I need to wash your feet," which he also, I think, says to all of us, that we must be cleansed by him, or we cannot do what we must do, what we're called to do, what we're required to do. So he washes their feet, and within hours he'll be going to the Garden of Gethsemane to pay for their sins and the cruel cross to die for them. Right between washing their feet and dying for them, he says, "Love one another the way I have loved you." And boy, that's a pretty good definition of motherhood, isn't it? In motherhood, don't you literally go into the valley of the shadow of death, and you certainly wash feet and bottoms, and Jesus didn't explicitly mention that, but it's the whole gamut in parenting, especially mothering. So that's the standard, and if I emphasize that, it's probably because it tends to get so badly neglected in most parenting programs. The disconnect between what research has taught us and what's getting taught in parenting programs is enormous and very unfortunate. You probably know about the idea of languages of love, and one of the publications back there talks about languages of love, so I point you to that. Tuning into the way each child prefers to be loved. Let's see if we can get that to advance. I might resort to the old-fashioned way. I had an experience when I was teaching high school. Before I went back to get a PhD, I was teaching high school math. And one of my students one day in geometry, a kid named Scott, a kid I really enjoyed, he said, "Mr. Goddard, do you want to go up on Saturday morning about 6 and watch the ducks up at the reservoir?" "No, I don't know. What do you do usually Saturday mornings at 6? Right? But I thought, one of our family mottos is, why not? Why not? Why not? Wouldn't that be fun? Let's try it. So I said, "Sure, Scott, that'd be great. Is it okay if I bring some cameras and take some pictures?" And he said, "That'd be great." So Scott picked me up in his old beat-up pickup truck on Saturday morning at 6, and we went up to Stanaker Reservoir, and we crawled through the mud and the cattails up to the edge of the reservoir, and he started pointing out the different ducks. I think he knew them all on a first-name basis. And then he just was in heaven. And then the key to this story is later, on another occasion after geometry class, he said, "Mr. Goddard, my dad's taking me up to Montana big game hunting. He's arranged a guide, a lodge, and the works, and we're going big game hunting." I'm thinking, dang, that's like years of a teacher's salary. And I said to him, "Scott, you must be really excited." And he said, "Well, not really. I just wish my dad would go watch the ducks with me." It's not the size of the gift. It's the customization, that it's the right thing for the right child at the right time. And that's a hard lesson. It keeps us always stretching to pay attention to what matters to each child. So 5-to-1 nurturing, and there's that publication, Sending Messages of Love. Principle number 4, I think I have a whole minute to talk about this. But you know, it's kind of not fair if the last session went over 10 minutes. Okay, I'll try to be nice. Encourage internalized control. I don't have time to tell you that story, but I can tell you that we divide control techniques into 3 kinds. Power assertion, "You'll do it because I say so," or love withdrawal, "Oh, I'm so disappointed in you." And time out can actually take that form often. Or induction, reasoning with children, helping them understand the effect of their behavior on others, is what we call induction. And the research is really clear that power assertion results in reactance, which might be rebelliousness, or in girls, it's often passivity. They give in and say, "Okay, run my life." Now, when they let someone else run their life after you're done, that's not usually good for them. Love withdrawal is not very effective. It's often associated with guilt in children. Induction results in all the good outcomes: greater self-confidence, greater competence, greater accomplishment in school, better moral development, everything that you want in your children results when parents use induction, at which point you say, so I don't really understand induction. I'd say, yeah, I'm not surprised because we don't talk about it very much, but here are the essential elements. It minimizes the use of power. It doesn't use power as the primary tool for influencing children. Reasons with the child, providing explanations or reasons. Helps them understand why we do certain things. It helps the children understand the effect of their behavior on themselves and others. It invites perspective taking to think about how this behavior impacts someone else. It seeks voluntary compliance. Son, would you be willing to help Widow Jones? She was frightened by the fireworks you put on her porch the other day. Would you be willing to, we seek ways to engage them in remedying the harm they have done. And it's all in the context of a loving, supportive, caring relationship. Now, when I first studied in graduate school, when I first read Rollins and Thomas summarizing the research on induction, I thought, they swiped this. They swiped this from Section 121 of the Doctrine and Covenants. No power or influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of parenthood. Only by persuasion, long-suffering, gentleness, meekness, and love unfeigned. Reproving betimes with sharpness, etc. That is the finest description of good parenting I have ever read. That describes the way we should exercise control in family relationships. And it's really about influence rather than control. There is a publication in the back called Something Better Than Punishment. And you're not going to be surprised to hear me recommend that to be more effective as parents, we should involve Jesus. Every day I cry out, O Jesus, thou Son of God, have mercy on us. What worked to transform Alma's life can work to transform every day of our lives. Now, before I talk about pastries, which is a sweet subject on which to conclude, I want to mention that I brought some parenting books that I've written. One about 50 things to do instead of getting angry with children. I've mentioned Between Parent and Child. This is a summary of these principles that we've just talked about. And this is my newest book that summarizes the research in all three areas. Some of these are available for purchase if you're interested. Let me tell you about the bakery. A guy who had told his coworkers that he was going to be healthier than he'd ever been before showed up one day at work carrying a very rich and enormous coffee cake. And his coworkers chided him and said, hold it, we thought you turned over a new leaf. And he said, just a moment. This is a very special coffee cake. And they laughed. And he said, no, really. He said, normally I don't go past the bakery anymore because I don't want to be tempted. But this morning, I found myself right in front of the bakery. And so I prayed and I said, Lord, if you want me to have that coffee cake, make a parking place for me right in front of the bakery. And he said, sure enough, on the eighth time around the block, there was the parking place. Now, I tell that story not about bakeries, but about parenting. If you fail at parenting yesterday and today and tomorrow, what matters is that you go around the block again. And then you say, I learned something from that. I never want to do that again. And I want to do something that's different, that's better, that's more loving, that's more helpful. I want to use the principles that God has given me and that maybe good research has given. See, I happen to believe that when people gather data on the realities of parenting, it says exactly what God's been saying all along. There is not a conflict that I've ever discovered in the parenting research between research and religion. So I recommend that we keep going around the block and we listen to Jesus, who is our advocate with the Father and is pleading our cause before him. And as we do that, as we feel his love flowing into us, we will better be able to send love to our children. Those he has called us to serve. May God bless you. Thank you for being here.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.